minus driven, some other factors. So, yeah, that modelling is certainly developing, and it does help us to think through the drivers of risk and the contributions that they're making. But it's certainly complex.
We will be right back with Hamish Clark on World Wildfires.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
We return to Gazing in the Flames, a review of world wildfires in a hotter world. Our guest is Dr. Hamish Clark from the University of Melbourne in Australia. Well, you have to have an ignition source to have a fire, and it could be a downed power line, a car fire, or arson. But the largest fires with the biggest carbon consequences, I think, seem to come from wildlands after being set on fire by lightning. And some studies suggest lightning will increase in the, well, at least in some regions as the world warms. How do you see the role of lightning in future wildfires?
Yeah, it's a huge X factor. Up until, you know, maybe 3 to 5 years ago, there'd been extremely few studies of this. I think it may be a combination of improvements in climate modelling where we're able to kind of include more and have less that's just kind of a simple, you know, assumption or parameterization. We're starting to get some of the dynamics of the drivers of lightning. I think as more research comes out, I've seen probably more predicting an increase than a decrease, but it's certainly not uniform. And as you rightly pointed out, there's going to be important spatial variations and no doubt seasonal variations. But yeah, lightning has historically been the major cause of fire until humans came along and started setting fires. And then in this day and age, again, as you pointed out, you know, we start fires in all kinds of weird and wonderful and often accidental ways. So those human-caused fires tend to understandably cluster around human settlements, around infrastructure, you know, power lines and roads. And so there's potentially a different set of, you know, research questions and management options and tactics. Lightning is a bit harder to control, and some of the biggest fires, this goes for black summer fires, but, yeah, all around the world are actually lightning-driven. And they're essentially uncontrollable, so we are very much vulnerable to changes in those patterns. And of course, the dry lightning is the key, is when it happens and it's not accompanied by a huge amount of rain. And then if the landscape is primed for fire, if it's been dry, for example, that's when those, you know, lightning ignitions can lead to fires that end up becoming big and hard to control.
In your review, though, you take care not to demonize all fires as only a threat to humans. Do you want to just talk quickly about how humans and natural systems use fire beneficially?
Yeah, I can give it a crack. I mean, one of the really rewarding things about working in fire is how diverse and complex it is, and it touches on so many strands of human knowledge and, you know, many scientific disciplines, but, of course, many things outside science. And, you know, I personally think it's really rewarding but also important to stress that, because if we're not careful, we can kind of slip back into probably more simplistic views, you know, fire is the enemy, we need to destroy it and fight it. And to some extent, that's true in some locations and places, but our relationship with fire goes back much further and is much richer than that. And particularly here in Australia, as I mentioned, you know, we've got this incredible record of oldest living continuous cultures on Earth, settlement 60,000 or more years, incredible diversity, right? So changes from region to region, you know, Aboriginal nation to nation. They were using fire to care for country. They weren't looking at fire through a risk lens, although their practices probably did decrease risk. It was about, you know, biocultural landscapes and about listening to country, relating to country, using fire. So a really different way of relating to the environment and to fire to what we're used to. But it's also finally receiving a bit more recognition. There's kind of cultural burning units cropping up in environment departments. There's a lot of conversation, a lot of research, a lot of practice, legislative changes, you know, are afoot. And so I guess a little bit of a renaissance in that is really encouraging. And I think, you know, more broadly, it's always important to include and recognise different kinds of knowledge. And that goes for Indigenous knowledge, but also operational knowledge, which doesn't always get written up in papers, and the lived experience of communities too. There are many other kind of human and cultural uses of fire too, you know, the kind of classic campfire. There's some that are more I guess, harmful, you could argue, in terms of deforestation fires happening in tropical areas. And often these are kind of, you know, economically driven, people trying to make a living. But a lot of deforestation is associated with fire as well. Not my area of expertise, but there's certainly a very wide range of human uses of fire. Probably would just quickly end by pointing out to a, you know, pretty significant operational use of fire, and that's prescribed burning. Also not without its, you know, complexity and controversy, but a really important part of current fire management practices.
Your team says, quote, "The consequences of climate change will lead to fire activity that exceeds the limits of suppression resource capacity. In other words, fires too big to fight. If fires become more extreme, partly because of climate change, does that suggest maybe international cooperation to fight fires may become as necessary as military alliances?"
Yeah, look, those cooperation and interagency kind of exchanges are already happening and have been for some time. So I'm most familiar with exchanges between Australia and North America, but I've got no doubt there are other ones. I think people coming to New Zealand, South Africa possibly, and, you know, no doubt there's others that I'm not aware of. So yes, this certainly is an issue. And, you know, for a country as big as Australia, there's regular flux of people, you know, throughout the regions and the states and territories as well. So I've got no doubt that this is going to be an active area of development and growth. We can throw more resources at things, you know, we can throw more tools, you know, planes, techniques, but, you know, the whole point of suggesting that they're beyond our capacity to suppress is, you know, at least temporarily, that's just the case, you know, and that's what's happening with emergency fires. You know, we can do some things, we can certainly try and protect life and property, but we really can't, you know, control everything that the fire is doing. It's really serious and it's a cause for concern and requires, you know, planning and kind of long-term thinking about how we can set up ourselves and the kind of towns and homes and regions that we live in to be as resilient as possible to these increases in risk. Obviously, it would be nice if we actually took much stronger and much more urgent action against climate change, you know, reducing greenhouse gas emissions, fossil fuel burning, etc. Fire is complex enough as it is without increasing the risk through climate change.
From what we know so far, Hamish, do you think there are tipping points in fire behavior?
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, for listeners who aren't familiar with that term, tipping points has been floating around for a while in the context of climate change projections and impact assessments. We're probably all familiar with gradual change. You know, we all get taller gradually. I'm getting balder gradually. But many changes in life can be much more sudden. There seems to be no change at all, and then all of a sudden there's a big change. So with climate change, you know, we're looking at changes in temperature and rainfall and various other, you know, aspects of the climate system. But there's also some aspects that might change more radically. You know, changes in, you know, ocean circulation, ice and glacier loss kind of accelerating. Not my area of expertise, but basically it's an active area of interest is these kind of major sudden changes rather than the more gradual ones. And, you know, the fact that they're major and sudden means even if we decide there's a relatively small chance of them happening, we really need to think through what the consequences would be of them happening because they're so major. And so in terms of fire, I guess there's a few kind of examples that come to mind. You know, but maybe the simplest one is just an escalation in fire behaviour where we have an increasing amount of fires that are just not possible to control. And certainly, you know, that can wear down people, wear down systems, wear down firefighters, communities. You often see tipping points in the context of vegetation change. So there's this really useful concept of a fire regime, sometimes called a fire regime niche or a pyro region. There's probably a handful of other terms, but it's essentially a patch of landscape, a certain kind of vegetation, but also a certain kind of fire, a certain flavour of fire. And wherever you or your listeners are locally, you'll probably know a lot about your local fire regime or in your local, you know, forest, grasslands, wherever you are. So this normal kind of fire is referring to how often it happens, how big they tend to be, are they kind of, you know, grassy or woody fuel. And it includes the normal extremes, if you'll pardon the expression. So you might get a normal fire once every 5 or 10 years, but a big extreme one once every, you know, 20 to 50 years, for example. So this idea of a fire regime, and so if you think about tipping points with fire, what if the fire regime changes? What if the vegetation all of a sudden shifts from forest to a grassland, obviously that's going to radically change, you know, all of the properties of the fire regime from, you know, frequency to intensity to the rest of it. You know, if vegetation is burnt too frequently to recover, then, it will change. You know, different kinds of vegetation will crop up. But I think we've already seen changes in vegetation. I don't know how confident we are that they're all being fire-driven compared to, other pressures, human activities, climate, etc. But I think that's, significant cause for concern is kind of a change in the fire regime, which then, makes it much harder to predict what's going to happen. I guess there's another, going back to an earlier part of our conversation, where areas that weren't fire-prone are becoming fire-prone. You could think of that as a kind of tipping point. And then, I don't know if you were going to ask about this later, but we allude in the paper to kind of permafrost and areas that are kind of thawing and melting and, we have this kind of fascinating phenomenon of overwintering fires, but basically areas that are kind of frozen or otherwise very generally impervious to fires or resistant to fires, all of a sudden fire coming in and changing things, potentially releasing a large amount of carbon in the process. So there's a number of them. And I think it's probably fair to say we're still getting our heads around exactly how severe they are and where they are and how likely they are.
Yes, we just got news in British Columbia. There are at least a dozen wildfires still burning, some under the snow, and they're expected to come up again in the spring. So some of them are surviving. And there's a new factor in fire impact, and that's really political retrogression. I mean, the United States, they're shutting down research into better fire prediction. They're reducing national support for fire prevention and firefighting and even public aid after a terrible fire. That's happening in the United States. How about Australia and other countries?
Yeah, look, thankfully, no, I would say. I'd say there's still pretty good support for fire management research, research into biodiversity and various other aspects. You'd always like to see more, but I understand we're operating in a resource-constrained environment. There's many other hazards. We have heat waves, we have floods, we have tropical cyclones. But broadly speaking, I would say there's still a reasonable consensus across the political spectrum and across society that we need to be investing in management of natural hazards, in research into them. One area I think we probably need to invest more in is recovery. I have some colleagues working in this area, and it seems that a lot of the focus is on the immediate aftermath of an incident, which is understandable, first 24 hours or 72 hours. But we know hazards, major fires and other events can impact people for decades. We're looking at impacts on physical health, mental health, relationships, education, employment, so many things. Often the instinct, it seems, is to go and rebuild a bridge or a road and kind of declare the recovery or the repair done, rebuild a house, for example. But it's much more complex than that. And unfortunately, as we're seeing, compound hazards, cascading hazards, a flood one year, a flood the next, maybe a fire the one after that, and as they increase in intensity and, extreme, then it's really important that we think about how we look after our communities, our frontline workers, firefighters, emergency management responders, community social services, all those things. So I would say, we're very privileged in Australia, relatively speaking. It obviously depends where you are and who you are. We still have, unfortunately, reasonable levels of poverty. We still have marginalised communities, particularly Indigenous communities, but overall, we're in a relatively strong position, and hopefully we can use that to kind of keep pushing for the important work that needs to be done across the spectrum.
As we wrap this up, what are you working on now?
Yeah, right now I was lucky enough to get what's called an industry fellowship from our national research funding body, the Australian Research Council. So it's an amazing opportunity to work for the next 4 years. I'm 6 months into it, so the next 3.5 years, with the lead fire management agencies in Victoria. And in Australia, they are really, this is the Department of Energy, Environment and Climate Action, DECA, and the Country Fire Authority, CFA. And we've also got the National Natural Hazards Funding Body, Natural Hazards Research Australia, on board as a partner too. So I'm working closely with them. I've got a postdoc working with me, Marikara Bonza. I've got a PhD student, Luane Tikupa-Borges, working with me. Another RA, Caitlin Simon. Another RA, Amelia French. So what we're really interested in is how effective fire management is at the moment and how resilient it is to climate change. So we're particularly interested in understanding the operational reality. So we really want these to be co-designed research, you know, deeply informed by the knowledge and priorities in agencies, and trying to find out where we can add value. You know, some areas are reasonably well researched. I wouldn't say we're out of questions, but something like prescribed burning, there's been quite a lot of research on. Hasn't been as much on suppression. There's been very little compared to that on community engagement. So we're really interested in, across the spectrum of kind of the response to emergencies and disasters, what works, you know, what's going to work in a hotter, more extreme world, and where can we kind of direct resources to increase effectiveness. So yeah, very interested in the kind of that applied research of understanding climate change impacts on fire management. I've just been chatting with Mike Flanagan, who was one of my co-authors on this paper, who helped me kind of dream it up, and we've actually decided to do something similar, but specifically looking at climate change impacts on fire management. And so it's possible this time next year I'd be ready to have another conversation along these lines about that paper. Beyond that, I've got lots of other interests. You know, I love working across disciplines and sectors. Fire and climate change are good places to do that. There's already pretty good connections, but I think we can do a lot better, particularly bringing in things like the humanities and the law. And I'm also personally quite interested in creative approaches to communication. So, you know, cartoons and design and different ways of bringing different stakeholders together, growing understanding, working with students, community members, and things like that. So they're some of the things that I'm privileged to spend my time on.
From the FLAIR Wildlife Research Group, University of Melbourne, we've been speaking with Dr. Hamish Clark. Find links to all the science and news we just talked about in my weekly show blog at Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Hamish, thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thanks very much for having me, Alex. All the best.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Covering the world, this is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
It's not your imagination. More of the United States burned in recent decades, and more buildings too. Rising insurance rates tell the tale, if you can get insurance. This is no surprise in a hotter world, but as always, humans complicate the picture. Scientists are racing to grasp and predict wildfire threat. Let's get the facts. Amanda Carlson is lead author of the new study, Rising Rates of Wildfire Building Destruction in the Conterminous United States. Dr. Carlson is a physical research scientist with the Geosciences and Environmental Change Science Center. From Denver, Colorado, Amanda Carlson, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
It seems like fires are more intense and going where they never go before. Is that just more media coverage, sensationalism, or has the American experience with fire been different in this young century?
Yeah, so a lot of research over the last several years have shown that wildfires are increasing, particularly in the northwestern U.S., particularly in western forests. Our study looked at the rate of building destruction from wildfires and how that's changed from 2002 to 2022. So our main finding from the study was that the rate of destruction has significantly increased over the past two decades.
What I find strange about that is, and you say this in the paper, that global burned areas have decreased since the late 20th century. Why should we be concerned about wildfire impacts if burned areas are on the decline?
That's not just a matter of how much area burns. So first of all, those global trends are a little bit complicated when you look at more regional trends. So as I mentioned earlier, we're not necessarily seeing increases in burned area across all of the U.S., but particularly in the western forested regions, we have been seeing significant increases. And it's also a matter of how wildfires behave, how intensely they burn, how quickly they spread.
Okay, so now this next is a huge subject, but could you introduce us to some of the ways climate change contributes to more wildfires or more damaging wildfires in the U.S.?
So in regions where we've had a lot of frequent fire in the past, like in the southwest United States, we have climates that are suited for wildfire, so not necessarily that we're getting more burned area, but we can get more extreme droughts. More extreme weather conditions that can result in more extreme fire behavior. And the data over the past few years has shown wildfires are spreading at faster rates and growing larger, burning at higher intensities. And then at the same time, in regions that are colder and wetter, where fires have historically been more limited by climate, we see a more frequent occurrence of conditions that can lead to large fires, and particularly in areas where you have a lot of fuels, like really dense forests, that can lead to really high-intensity fires.
A long-standing question raised by several studies, are damages increasing because more people move into fire-prone zones, and or has poor fire management contributed? Can your new study add more certainty about what is driven by social change and what by climate-induced forces?
Yeah, so we know that the wildland-urban interface is increasing in area. We know more home development compounds how many people are exposed to wildfires when they occur. So a combination of more fire, more intensely burning fires, and more people in the UI is definitely something that's exacerbating wildfire problem. However, a key finding of this study was that the increase in building destruction over the last two decades is not necessarily just because the number of buildings exposed to fires have increased. We actually found that the rate of destruction, or the number of buildings that are destroyed relative to each building that's exposed, is what's increased most dramatically. So that would potentially indicate that it's not so much a matter of building more into fire-prone areas as it is that the fires are just becoming harder to control and communities are becoming more vulnerable.
In two of the most costly fire zones, the Western United States and Eastern Australia, Aboriginal people say they previously used fire itself selectively as a management tool. Is there a case for applying more Aboriginal knowledge to growing fire threats? What are your thoughts?
I mean, definitely that's an area that is of growing interest. I think there's a growing recognition that these forests, these sagebrush ecosystems, shrubland ecosystems have been managed for a long time by indigenous fire, and there's definitely a need to apply more fire to the landscape, more treatments, both in terms of cultural burning, intentional prescribed fire, mechanical fuel treatments, and grazing and things like that. These are all things that can be effective in reducing hazardous fuel loads.
Well, we know one urban fire can leave ecological and human scars possibly for decades, and it seems fire is an event-driven driver rather than a gradual phenomenon like rising seas. But it seems some climate models don't handle quick, fast events that then disappear as well as they do averages of things. So are the models, in your opinion, keeping up with what's happening on the ground with wildfires?
I think models can give us an idea of the frequency of weather conditions that would lead to large extreme fires. Modeling individual fires is a very difficult process, though. There's a lot of randomness in terms of day of weather, where ignitions occur, and whether ignitions occur close to communities that are vulnerable.
Former Governor Ronald Reagan famously said fire season is now all year in California, and we know the length of fire season per se has increased. Is that because of climate change, and are you seeing that in your studies?
So a lot of the most destructive fires that we looked at in our data set have occurred outside of the fire season. So where I am in Colorado, we had the Marshall Fire, which occurred over New Year's in 2021. So that was definitely something that occurred outside of the typical fire season and was one of the most destructive events we've had in Colorado history. And that said, you can't necessarily attribute single weather events to climate change.
Los Angeles required basic fire protection around homes. They call it a defensible space. And there are things we can do. Do you want to talk to us about that?
Yeah, so one thing we plan to do with the data set we built, where we're mapping locations of building loss, we want to be able to take a more detailed look at what spatial factors are influencing the probability of buildings surviving versus being destroyed. So defensible space, I think we know from individual case studies that that's been an important factor in the past, so we hope to gain a better understanding of that. Broadly speaking, in this study, we looked at types of vegetation, and we found that higher proportions of forest vegetation specifically contribute to higher likelihoods of destruction, so that could have potential implications for management.
So is wildfire just a worry for Americans living in the West? Because just recently we saw some fires in New Jersey, which were unexpected, one in New York City. What would we say to our Eastern listeners?
I'd say the occurrence of destructive fires is definitely less common in the East than in the West. However, one of the things we looked at in this study was how the vegetation affects the likelihood of destruction. And what we found in the few destructive fires we did see in the eastern U.S. was that a lot of these communities are built with a lot of wildland urban interface and a lot of forest vegetation. So those events do have the potential to be highly destructive. And in fact, one of the most destructive fires that we mapped in our data set was the Chimney Tops fire in eastern Tennessee in 2016. So the combination of a lot of forest vegetation and a lot of populations living in proximity to forests does create the potential for really destructive events if you have the right weather conditions.
Your study period ended before the January 2025 urban fires in Los Angeles. Do you think that would fit in with what you found, or is that possibly something new?
Yeah, so that would have been pretty interesting to look at, because one of the main findings of this study was that one of the most important drivers for increasing rates of building destruction was the fact that more destructive fires have been occurring in forests, particularly in Northern California, Oregon, and Washington. But at the same time, we did see that the majority of buildings destroyed by fire are in grassland and shrublands, like we saw in Los Angeles in the 2025 fires. And we saw the rate of destruction in those ecosystems increasing over time. So it's those dual factors that fires in forests are more destructive and we're having more of them, but also that fires in grass and shrublands are becoming more destructive as well, driven by more extreme fire weather conditions. So I think looking at the Los Angeles fires would have probably highlighted that finding that destruction rates are increasing in grass and shrublands as well.
Amanda, what are you working on these days?
I'm hoping to dive deeper into this data set we created, looking at more detailed models of risk and trying to understand factors that affect community vulnerability.
From the U.S. Geological Survey in Denver, our guest is Amanda Carlson. We discussed her new paper, Rising Rates of Wildfire Building Destruction in the Conterminous United States. Find links to the science and news we just talked about in my show blog, Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Amanda, thank you for spending time with our listeners.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning into the news from the now unnatural world. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Join us again next week. Tears down our cheeks for the memories of our burned down town. Burn down town. Burn it down. Burn it all down. Fossil fuel.
This is CJSF 90.1 FM. Broadcasting to you from Simon Fraser University's Burnaby campus in British Columbia.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections.
In Edina, Minnesota, some residents are leaving their cars at home and riding electric bikes that the city helped pay for.
We last year added e-bikes as one of the projects that we help fund so that folks can have an alternative to car travel.
Matthew Gabb, sustainability specialist for the Minneapolis suburb, says most of Edina's carbon pollution comes from buildings and transportation. So to reduce those emissions, the city created a climate action fund using fees paid by local utilities. The fund helps residents pay for energy-saving projects like weatherizing their homes, installing solar panels, or switching to efficient electric heat pumps. And every 3 months, 10 residents who are chosen by lottery each receive at least $500 toward an e-bike. One recipient told Gab that her family uses their e-bike to drop their kids off at school and for errands around town.
She was like, "This is great. Like, my family is growing, and we thought we might need to have a second car, and now we don't need to."
So Gab says the Climate Action Fund makes it easier for people to invest in solutions that reduce their carbon pollution and save them money over time.
our goal is empowering residents to be able to have more choices.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.